I decided 3 months in that I needed to write one of those kinds of books, write the book that I wasn't able to find for myself, basically. And that's the pivot, really. I mean, it was saying, okay, here I have this new thing that nobody expected. Looking back in the history of my life, there were symptom clusters all along. We now think that maybe I've had it since I was 9.
Lifelong journalist and creative writer Tamara Selman went back to school at 47 years old to study sleep technology. A lover of reading and writing, she was left in total shock and in a space of concern when she lost her ability to read or comprehend the words in her textbook while studying for exams. Welcome to The Safe Haven. I'm your host, Amanda Lytle. The Safe Haven offers a collection of conversations about life's challenges and the pivots we make in order to keep moving forward. Scans and tests confirmed her diagnosis with multiple sclerosis and led Tamara into a space of grief as she worked through processing this new information. As a writer, she worked through her grief and her new diagnosis with words and writing. Along with finding her people and learning to accept where she's at in every given moment, Tamara's time camping and being in nature allowed her the time and the space to process and write her book of poetry and insights titled Intention Tremor.
So I went back to school at the age of 47 to study sleep technology. I had been a lifelong journalist and creative writer. And as we know now, journalism is a really tricky business to be in. And so I was also at home raising kids. And I felt like if I wanted to compete in freelance journalism and writing, that I should probably have some kind of expertise to sort of separate me from the rest of the crowd. And I'd always wanted to get back into science writing. That was actually something that I was doing in college. And I'd done some other kinds of writing, but I really wanted to get back into science. And so my dad was a scientist. So, you know, it's kind of like something I naturally wanted to gravitate towards. So I went back to school to study sleep technology because I also have this huge fascination with dreams. And I had also had my own sleep study because I was going through these bouts of extreme fatigue and we're trying to figure out what was going on. And that's actually what inspired me to go back to school. So this is at age 46. And then in age 47, I was finally enrolled in this intense, it's called polysomnography program. And I was getting ready to study for finals, which is really hard at age 47. It's a really different learning curve and process when you're older and you've got, I'm raising teenagers, you know, at this point. And so I cracked open my gigantic sleep medicine textbook to do, you know, my study for my final exams. And I could see just fine, but I couldn't read. Now, I've worked as a journalist, a writer, an editor my whole life. I know how to read, and I know how to read a lot of things and a lot of hard things. And here I'm looking at this page, and it's clear as a bell. I can see it clearly, but I couldn't comprehend the language. I could see these figures, but I couldn't comprehend anything. And that was, you know, I have to say, that was terrifying because this is my identity. I've been a writer my whole life and a voracious reader. And just to not be able to read, it's like, it's just so important to who I am. So I called the doctor. He was actually able to get me right in, which was amazing. And in this little clinic out here in the sort of semi-rural part of the county, they have a portable out there with an MRI machine in it. And so he's like, asked me a bunch of questions. And he said, why don't you walk across the parking lot and go get an MRI and we'll just take a look. And 2 days later, he called me and said, we think that you have multiple sclerosis, but he couldn't diagnose me because that kind of diagnosis has to come from a neurologist. But I was just like, oh my gosh, because I'd had all these other symptoms at the same time and kind of throughout my life and didn't really put it all together. So I was having these problems with speech. I was getting tremors in my legs and my hands. I was getting these sweeping, tingling sensations across my body. I was, of course, really tired. I had ringing ears and I was getting these strange muscle contractions around my rib cage, which is ironically called the MS hug, in which your muscles and your diaphragm, they literally turn as hard as rock. And it's really hard to breathe because you need your muscles to breathe. And it's very painful. It's probably the most painful thing that I have going with MS. But anyway, so I went and I did all the other tests with the neurologist. in Seattle, great doctor, Dr. Keita, and she confirmed it 5 weeks later. Now, that is like super fast diagnosis process. Most people, or many people with MS, they might have to go a couple of years before they can get a confirmed diagnosis. So for me, it was lightning quick by comparison. And so here I am. I'm in college going back to school in this intensive science program in sleep medicine or sleep technology, and getting ready to do my overnight shifts, because that's how you learn it. You go and do your curriculum at the hospital, working with other sleep technologists and running sleep studies before you can get your certification. And then you go and sit for your exams for your credential. And I was facing all that going, what in the heck? And I was not even scared as much as I was so mad, because I was like, I've done all this work. I've been, you know, studying and doing great. And all of a sudden, and now this happens after I've invested all this time and energy in this new career path that I was so excited about. And so I did still complete my certification. I still completed all my 200 hours of, you know, service at the hospital working overnight shift. And I did get a job right after. In fact, I started my new job on the day that I first started my medication for MS, which is weird because all these medications have weird side effects and you just don't know what's going to happen. And I was just thinking, oh my gosh, I'm going to, you know, bloom a third eye in my forehead or something weird tonight because I have this new drug in my system and I don't know what to expect. So it was this weird journey. I wasn't sad or upset by it as I was angry, like I said, partly, thank goodness, because I had two people in my life, good friends who also have MS. And they were living their lives very fully. And one of them was at one time a life flight nurse, and then she was then working as a critical care nurse, which is hugely involving and physical and exhausting, but she was doing it. She just recently retired. And my other friend is a bookstore manager in the city. That's not easy work at all, and she's doing it. So I had, thank goodness, in my life, two people who gave me this example of it's okay. It's not a life sentence. So that's when I decided, well, I'm going to have to start saying no to a lot of things and just going to have to reset my priorities so that I can get through this. And then followed the whole process of, I guess, grieving, I would say the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross approach, where you go through all these stages. Because when you get diagnosed with a chronic incurable illness like multiple sclerosis, you're going to feel some grief. You're going to feel some loss. You're going to feel some anger. You're going to go through all the things. You're going to, you know, bargain. You're going to do all those things. And so for me as a writer, the way to process that process was through words, but through writing. And so I was working, but then I was keeping journals, all kinds of journals, sleep journals, symptom diaries, writing just anything down that I could about my experience, just trying to make sense of it. Cause that's how I work through things. That's my therapeutic process. And about 2 to 3 months into this new experience and diagnosis, I realized, well, a couple of things. When we get diagnosed with something like this, what do? And we shouldn't, but we do it anyway. We go online and we start looking around and we read everything. And fortunately, I feel like I have enough digital literacy to know the difference between good and bad information. Being a journalist, I have a bullshit meter, so that helps. Not everybody does, right? And so I went and learned everything I could. And then I discovered two things. One thing is that the doctors can be very helpful and you can have really great doctors and still not have the answers that you need. And number two, the people that are living with the conditions are the ones that are going to help you get through the day-to-day in a way that no doctor Google webpage or, you know, advice column from some clinician somewhere will ever do. So I decided to start looking for creative writing about living with MS. And I found some memoirs, some really great ones, one by Mitch Sturgeon, I would highly recommend. But I couldn't find very many books with poetry. And I think poetry sometimes can be a really interesting way to tell a personal story, because it's in these just little, intense little chunks that you can just sit there and meditate on and learn something from. And so I decided 3 months in that I needed to write one of those kinds of books, write the book that I wasn't able to find for myself, basically. And that's the pivot, really. I mean, it was saying, okay, here I have this new thing that nobody expected. Looking back in the history of my life, there were symptom clusters all along. We now think that maybe I've had it since I was 9.
Wow.
Yeah, right. My first MS hug happened when I was in August of 1975.
So you remember that moment then, clearly.
Oh, yes, because it was so painful and weird. And the response was so, nobody really questioned it. Here was this really healthy, muscular little girl out playing. I was a tomboy. I was out doing, playing in the woods and doing all kinds of stuff. And suddenly had this intense pain that literally I dropped to my knees. It's the very first piece in my book, Intention Tremor, is this recounting of this moment. And then nobody really paid much mind to it. And then a few weeks later, I ended up in the hospital with this mysterious kidney infection. Again, nobody really questioned. But then back then, this is 1975, they still really weren't able to clearly diagnose even adults with MS. Mm-hmm. So no one is going to even go there then. So it's really a no-fault situation. We just didn't know. And then I've had, you know, a lifetime of fatigue and a lifetime of other kinds of symptoms that now just like, wow, it all just kind of makes sense.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for sharing this. Oh my gosh. Okay. I have some questions because pre-recording, now I want to know the link with nature and camping because pre-recording, you'd mentioned the importance of nature and camping. So can you share a little bit about that?
Oh my gosh. Yes. Well, nature and camping, there is this thing called forest bathing. In Japan, it's called Shinrin Yoku. And I believe it's even like a national like healthcare policy. Pretty sure it's like a legit thing in Japan, and maybe it should be everywhere. If you ask me, it should be. There is something about trees and the compounds that they release into the air that when we go walking amongst them, they're healing properties. And some people will say that's really woo-woo, but there is actual science to back that up. And I can tell you for sure when I go out into the woods, it's like I become who I really am. I really feel like I'm my best person. I actually even like tell myself that I'm like, this is the person everyone should know, because when I'm not feeling well, then I'm not really not at 100%. Who is, right? But when I'm out in the woods, when I'm hiking, when I'm camping, sitting around a campfire or gardening, I do a ton of gardening. I have 3 giant raised beds and I grow lots of vegetables and herbs. When I go out there every day and get out my little garden hose and just poke around, I just feel so whole. It's amazing. It's an all encompassing holistic expression of wholeness. And yeah, so I wrote most of my book Intention Tremor, either from a travel trailer or from an Airbnb when I couldn't because it was snowing out. But I mostly was camping when I wrote all of these pieces. And if it was raining, I'd be inside. But if it wasn't raining, I'd be out by the campfire, staring at the moon, a lot of times staring at those coals, listening, taking in the smells from around me. You know, you can smell blackberries out in the woods. You can smell the mushrooms. You can smell the cedar and the pine and the dirt. And often I would camp up at Port Townsend at Fort Worden State Park, which is right on the salt water. So, you know, you could smell that too. I mean, to me, all of those things are just gateways into ideas. They just trigger creativity for me. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just so associate those things with being creative that by day I am a writer. I write columns about multiple sclerosis and sleep health. And I do that in my office. But when it comes to my creative writing, I really have to leave my office and be outside somewhere for it to really, not that that's a limitation, because I mean, I love going outside and doing that, but it brings a different perspective and a different doorways into my creative mind.
Hey listeners, we're going to just take a quick beat here. We'll be right back. Earlier you said that you wished you'd had this book, that you were starting to write a book you wish you'd had. So what does Intention Tremor give the world?
Well, it gives the world, I call it a medical memoir told in poetry. And actually it's this interesting cross-genre, cross-form hybrid collection, because I have been a cross-genre, cross-form writer my whole life. I'm a journalist. I write poetry. I write short stories. I write creative essays. I write prose poems, I write formal poems. I mean, I write all of it. I have novels that I'm still working on. And I've learned that I should just let the thing that I want to write gets to choose its form. I used to fight that. And I finally just said, just let it be what it wants to be. And that just lifted a huge weight off of me. A lot of pressure that I didn't need to experience just being creative. Just let it be what it wants to be. So interestingly, there's a sort of journey that I took with this book. Yeah, so I wanted to write this book that I wasn't finding anywhere else. And because it was very personal, but there are also aspects of science to it. There was, I mean, I do talk about certain tests that you have to undergo. And there's something called the JC virus that I kind of explore because it's very intrinsically linked to MS, especially when it comes to the medications you're taking and your risk factors. I talk about zebrafish, which are a kind of animal that are used in the labs to test all kinds of neurological, you know, treatments and so forth. And I really love that part of it. And I, you know, a lot of times when you're reading a memoir or even a collection of poetry, you don't always get the science aspect of a disease. And so I was able to do that. And it was so much fun and just was fun and playful for me. And I have to say that my book, I really didn't want it to be like a hero's journey, like I'm such a hero because I have this illness, because I think we all have things in our life that hold us back. And it doesn't have to be an illness, it could be anything. And I don't want to think of myself or anybody else as being a hero just for getting through your life. I mean, we all have setbacks, we all have things and obstacles that get in our way. This just happens to be mine. So I definitely believe you take lemons, you turn them into lemonade. And that's kind of part of what I put into my book. And I also didn't want it to be a woe is me tale. Yes, I have miserable days. I always, you know, we all do, whether we're sick or not. But I didn't want to capture that. I wanted to capture the day-to-day of, okay, here I have this diagnosis. Here are some things I've noticed about my body and how it doesn't work the same way. Here are some things I've noticed about how others interpret and engage with my experience with having illness. A lot of people who are healthy don't know how to engage with a person who has a chronic illness, and some of them don't want to. And some of them do, but in a way that's, it's well-meaning, but it doesn't, it's not supportive. Let's put it that way. And so as the person with illness, I have found that I've needed to find ways to address it with other people in a way that's educational, because a lot of people just don't know about it. I mean, I didn't, even with having two friends with MS, I still didn't know that much about it until I had it myself. And that's sort of the phrase that people use all the time is, you don't get it till you get it. And it's true. And that's, again, a no fault thing. I don't know a lot about a lot of other illnesses either because I don't have them. So I don't really blame people for not knowing. So I see discussions with people as opportunities to explore and share. I don't want people to feel sorry for me. I feel like I have it better than most people and I'm still living my full life. I think I'm living my life better now because of it, which is just so crazy. But you know, you get a diagnosis like this, you have to turn around and look at your priorities in life. You have to look at how you're taking care of yourself. And you have to look at things like, where's my energy going? And is it really worthwhile to spend it there? And following through all those inquiries, I just have been able to kind of carve out the life that I really wanted all along, is to be this person writing about illness, helping other people through my writing on my own terms, basically. Mm-hmm. And that means also being able to step aside and say, well, I can't do this today because I can't see very well today, or I, you know, I don't feel very good, or my energy is just depleted. And like, you know, today I'm kind of tired from a long, sunny weekend where we just took advantage of this great weather. And now I'm, you know, so today's going to be a slow day, and that's so fine. And being forgiving of yourself when you can't go 100% is super important.
Yeah. I was just going to ask you, I think you just answered everything that you just said in the last couple of minutes. I think it just answered the question I was going to ask, which was, what did this diagnosis change the most for you when it comes to the intention that you lead your life with?
Right.
You know, and it sounds like actually being able to make decisions and choices, putting yourself first, is huge.
It is huge. And, you know, one of the things that happens when you get diagnosed too is you can, and I think all of us do to some extent, no matter what it is, you fall into this thing that I call diagnosis mind, where it sort of shapes everything, creates this aperture that you look through life with. And if that's the correct way to say it, this aperture that only hones in on life with this awareness. Another example might be if you're a woman and you learn you're pregnant. Well, you really can't go back to understanding your body now in the same way, because now you know this new thing about your body and it's different. And it's like a point of no return. So you're pregnant. Now you can't really go back and say, well, I can choose not to be pregnant. No, you are pregnant now. And this is happening in your body, whether you can intellectualize it or not. And it's the same with illness. Once you get this information, you realize, okay, well, this is a whole new me. This is a new normal. And so the process is really about getting through that. And part of it is, like I'd mentioned earlier, the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross stages of grief thing. You kind of go through that. But diagnosis mind is this like pit that you can fall into where all you can see is shaded and colored by your illness. And what I mean by that is, like, if you have any kind of physical sensation, you're going to think, oh my God, is that my MS? And it could just be, I mean, this all happened at the same time that I was going through menopause. Mm-hmm. So who knows about some of those symptoms? And who knows, I was also a working mother in college. Who knows if I was just exhausted because I was a working mother in college. So it was really hard to know. And I also have other things like arthritis. Is that pain from MS or is that pain from arthritis? And you can't know. And at some point you just have to say, it doesn't matter. It's just there. It's what it is. Let's get through it and just move on and don't get stuck. So for me, diagnosis mind is kind of a little trap that we can fall inside. I think it's a natural place to go, just like in all of the mythologies and fairy tales, people do descend and go underground to have that growth experience. Well, the diagnosis mind starts out that way, but I think sometimes people get stuck there and then they never get out of it and then move on and get back to their lives. So I definitely had diagnosis mind for the first couple of years. And you could probably see some of that maybe in some of my poems, but after lots of revisions, I really wanted to make sure that people understood that I was a whole mentally healthy person that was just working through this stuff. And I wanted to create prose and poems that captured like all of the angles instead of just the physical. So there's some emotional stuff in there and there's some sense of humor stuff in there because you have to learn to laugh. Mm-hmm. And then the other part of it too is getting out of that diagnosis mind also required that I find my tribe. And when you find people that support you in whatever it is that you do, you can just be so much more productive and positive and forward thinking. And when I found my people with MS, it made all the difference. They're the ones that gave me the inspiration, the sense of humor, the tools, the ability to vent, the ability to laugh. And so I think of people like Dave Bexfield. He runs Active MSers, and he's this guy who travels all around the world with his wheelchair and his rollator and his arm braces and stuff. He takes pictures of himself at all these major landmarks and says, get out there and do it. And he's really into PT and go get your exercise in, go outside. And I mean, people like that, if you have them in your lives, they're just like gold. I mean, never trade them for anything.
I have a question about hitting rock bottom and just having those days that really suck.
Yeah.
What was it that kept pulling you forward? What was it that you could really turn inwards and connect with that kept you going?
Well, a couple of things. I would say at some point, just giving in and just saying, fine. My body is saying no. I mean, I have always gone go, 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 go my whole life. I've kind of hyper in that way. So it's really been hard to just say today is just not going to be that day because I'm so ambitious, you know. But you know what? Everything that you want to do is still going to be there when you're recharged. And the other thing I learned is really more like medical. I mean, your brain uses up huge amounts of glucose anyway, but when you have brain damage issues from multiple sclerosis, it uses up even more. When you run low on glucose, your whole body just goes, I'm so tired. So you learn to listen to your body. And so there are certain things, like I also have a lot of issues with sensory overload. So here's a great example. Early on, we decided we were going to go walk over on the ferry. We get on the ferry, walk over, and then walk up the hill in Seattle to the International District for Chinese New Year. Sounds great, right? And there's going to be food trucks everywhere, and there's going to be a parade and all of that. so much fun. And we got there, and it was so exhausting because I forgot that I have these issues with sensory overload. And what is Chinese New Year's? Nothing but sensory overload. You've got noise, you've got smells, you've got lots of color, you've got people everywhere, you've got taste because you're eating all these wonderful foods. I couldn't believe how exhausted I was. And I realized, you know, this is maybe not something I can do anymore. Or if I do it, I have to make sure and like plan a whole day off afterward to rest, because sometimes it's worth it. I mean, it was worth it and we had a great time. But then, you know, if I'm going to do it again, I'm going to take a day off afterward because I'm going to need to sleep, because that is really the way that you restore your glucose in your brain. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, learning to listen to my body and just not holding it against itself. If it tires out or if there's pain, you just listen and you recharge and then come back to it.
Mm, that's so good.
Oh, sure.
Just being super mindful of your time, I would love to ask you where people can find you online.
Yes.
And where they can get their hands on this book.
Oh, yes. Okay. So Intention Tremor, you can find it at intentiontremorbook.com. So direct link right to the page. You can find me at my blog website, rhymeswithcamera.com. That's how I tell people how to say my name, Rhymes with Camera. My Facebook page is TK Selman. Selman is S as in Sam, E-L-L-M-A-N. Twitter is at Selman Writer. Instagram is Tamara Selman and LinkedIn is Tamara Selman.
Oh, this is great, Tamara. Thank you. Okay. My three safe haven style questions. You ready?
Yay. Yes, I am.
What are you most proud of?
I am proud of what I say are my four children. I actually have two daughters. I'm super proud of them. They're in their 20s and they are killing it these days. Very strong young women and doing the things that matter to them. And I couldn't be more proud of them. Then my third child is my book, Intention Tremor. I'm really proud of it. I think it turned out beautifully. I really loved the production of it. I, you know, kudos to Moonpath Press and Lana Ayers for picking it up and putting it out in the world. I'm so ever grateful for that. And then I'm also very proud of my writing life. That's my fourth child, because I think without this writing life, I don't know who I could possibly be without it. It is everything to me. And all the people that are in it and all the books that I've read. I mean, what a great place to live your life is within these pages and words.
Yeah, I can understand that everything that you've read has contributed so much to who you are in some tiny or humongous way.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
What would you like to be known for?
I'd like to be known for being a truth teller. I always have been. It doesn't always make me the most popular person in the room. I try to be polite. But I do think we need to tell the truth. And I think, especially in this time and place, being authentic and truthful and honest about things that are hard could not be more important. Mm-hmm.
And if you had a message for everyone listening, what would it be?
Chronic illness is not a life sentence. That's one. It is not a life sentence. You just figure out how you get to where you want to go through a different path. And you will find a way. If you really want to do something, you will find a way. Your desire to write your own personal story must begin and end with you. And that means you're going to have to mind some stuff. I mean, a lot of people will write for a lot of other reasons. But if you really want people to enjoy and appreciate and be moved by your work, you have to mind things within yourself and start there. And then I would say that you need to learn to say no to the things that you can do well, but don't feed your soul. Because I get asked a lot to do a lot of things, and I know I could do them and I could do them well for other people, but they don't feed my soul. And that is how I draw the line when it comes to living my best life now as a person with a chronic illness. I have to say no. So I say no to those things that aren't also going to pay back in spades for me. And that's not being selfish. That's just saying, this is my life and these are my terms.
I feel that to my core.
Yay.
Tamara, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thank you. This has been really fun. And I just love talking about camping and stuff. So I'm glad that we were able to talk about nature as part of that. You know, even though my creative life seems very intellectual, it really has this very tactile relationship with the natural world. And I'm so happy to talk about that.
Tamara, thank you so, so much for joining me as a guest on The Safe Haven. I love that you reached out and were so keen on being a guest. So thank you so much for your time, for your vulnerability, and for your stories. To everyone listening, I recognize the privilege that comes with my platform, and I am committed to creating a safe, brave, and inclusive space with intention. If this episode has hit you right in the heart or inspired you in any way, please screenshot the screen while you're listening, send it to your friends, and share it in your Instagram stories. Please be sure to tag us at The Safe Haven Podcast so we can personally thank you for it. If you're able to write a review or leave a juicy 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts, that really helps this podcast grow. For more great podcasts, check out frequencypodcastnetwork.com, and I will talk to you next week.